extra time.
Hello and welcome back to the Extra Time podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and this week I'm joined by two very special guests. It's Joe Tomlinson. Hello, Joe Tomlinson. How are you?
Hello there, Patrick Van Straten. I'm very well, thank you, my friend. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And Chris Hamill, how are you?
Oh, I'm a little bit pissed off. Processing issue on Winners and Losers. So getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning to edit it effectively, you know, wasn't worth it.
I also have started paying the slightest bit of attention to the Scottish League just so that I have something in my back pocket the next time I want to annoy you. And it does seem weird that Celtic are currently second in a one-horse race. Like, how have they managed that?
Yeah, we were bad at the weekend. And had the game gone on another 5 minutes, Aberdeen definitely would have won. So it was a strange sensation for me to, like, when the final whistle was blown at Pittodrie, a blustery Pittodrie, mate, I was actually quite relieved with a 3-3 draw.
I can't believe you're actually going to miss out on 10 in a row.
Well, what are your thoughts on Eddie Howe taking over? I've heard Eddie Howe could be coming through the door.
Oh, he's not a big club manager, is he? And, you know, Rangers looked pretty good last December when they beat Celtic at Parkhead before they totally bottled it. So it's a long old season. And, you know, Rangers have still got it in them to completely capitulate.
Well, on the topic of leagues where there are actually no good teams whatsoever, let's talk about the Premier League where everybody is rubbish. I thought that it was
great.
A weekend of garbage football all round, really. Invincible's Day came early this year, the day on which no team can complete the season unbeaten, as Everton lost to Southampton, Villa lost in comprehensive fashion to a really impressive Leeds side, who I think we're going to talk about later. And I think right now, Liverpool currently look like the only competent side in the league. And even they weren't like that exciting. They're just better than most other sides. United and Chelsea looked totally toothless. Leicester were absolutely awful against Arsenal and yet still won because Arsenal are even worse.
Well,
I mean, like, there's just nobody competent in the league.
I'm going to have to agree to disagree there. I thought Leicester were very good in the second half.
You can't pop. They had four shots, man. Come on.
Come on. That doesn't always paint the full picture. The game plan was executed wonderfully. Nampoli's Mendy is a man reborn, bossing that
you
midfield.
You can't possibly say the game plan was executed well when there was a perfectly good goal ruled out for offside. And then Alexandre Lacazette missed a header from, what, 6 inches out in the first half? Is that an example of the game plan going well?
Was that from the Tierney cross?
Yeah.
How did you take it when the commentator announced that that was, in fact, Kieran Tierney's fault for putting the ball in too fast?
Oh, well, obviously. I mean, like, of course it's his fault for putting it in too fast. It's like God's fault, isn't it, for, like, making the light too bright or something in Lacazette's eyes. Like, there's always some stupid contrarian view that a commentator takes. But I just kept seeing after the game people say, like, Brendan Rodgers, another tactical masterclass. And I was like, oh, here we are again. I also saw somebody say something like, Brendan Rodgers getting it right against the top teams again. And I thought, isn't that notoriously what Brendan Rodgers has not been good at? But yeah, I don't know. I thought that Leicester were outshot 11-1 in the first half. Their only effort was a long-range attempt to score into an open goal from James Maddison. They were pretty dreadful. Arsenal were very bad in the second half, but still created the Bayern chance, I think. Overall, I thought it was pretty even, and Leicester scored a good goal, and Arsenal just aren't very creative. But I don't know,
Leicester played well. Gabriel, ooh, just to comply and, you know, adopt the attitude and approach of every other Arsenal defender in the face of Jamie Vardy and just a crumple like origami. Like, as he came on, it was like a Death Eater had entered the field on the Emirates. Like, Arsenal were so scared of him that I found it, you know, just wholly entertaining and quite wholesome to watch, yeah.
But weren't both...
I have to say...
I don't know. I thought both Vardy's chances were Mustafi's fault, but yeah, okay.
I have to say, neutral perspective, I can't say I watched the full game. I probably switched on at about 60, 70 minutes. But from what I saw, and I've been told by other people this isn't true, but I mean, the state of Gabriel's passing out of the back was unbelievable in the last 20 minutes.
It got worse and worse as the game went on.
I don't know what was going on. And I did want to speak to you about this, Pato, about the Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang situation, because his current XG per 90 is 0.08. Across the course of the season, I think he's got the 77th worst XG in the league. So at what stage does Arteta just play him down the middle?
Mate, I've been saying this for weeks. Like, there's absolutely no disagreement from me on this. Like, Aubameyang has been dreadful so far this season. Dreadful. Even in this game, you know, like, Lacazette missed that Tierney chance, but he did actually score a perfectly good goal. Like, Aubameyang was basically anonymous, though he did produce a very good cross for that Bellerin chance in the second half. But, yeah, I mean, I don't really understand. What I don't understand is the idea that playing Aubameyang down the middle is going to solve all our problems. I think that that is a bit of a myth that Arsenal fans have created because they don't want to face the fact that they just don't have a very good team. And to be honest, a bigger problem I thought yesterday was Saka coming off. When Saka and David Luiz came off, Mustafi made mistakes for the Vardy goal and for the Vardy chance later in the game. And Saka was pretty much the only person creating anything at all for us. But yeah, I mean, it's a real concern. And Arsenal have really locked into that contract. Like, they've locked into that contract. They've locked into Willian's contract. And both of those players have been not just, like, not great so far this season, but, like, actually god-awful. They've both been terrible so far this season. Aubameyang, you assume, will be able to turn it round to some degree. But you'd have thought that 20 goals for the season is basically gone. And at that point, you think, well, you're paying him a lot of money for maybe a 15-goal striker. And this was people saying, what will Arsenal do if they sell Aubameyang? How could they possibly replace him? Getting a 15-goal-a-season striker is actually not that hard. So, yeah, I don't know, man. Like, it's a big... But you know what my bigger concern is? I thought Leicester were kind of like boxing around Partey to stop him getting on the ball in this game, and it was always going to Xhaka. But Partey on his debut in the Europa League, I thought was fantastic. He had an amazing debut. And you know what? Arsenal was still terrible, which is exactly the point, right? That we were like, Thomas Partey's not going to solve Arsenal's issues. And Thomas Partey was great on his debut. He was pretty good when he did get on the ball in the Leicester game. And Arsenal was still not good. And that, to me, is a serious warning sign for the way that they're currently building the squad at this club.
So how would you like to see them set up? Because I still feel like it's so unbalanced, that team. And I understand that Xhaka is vital to how they want to play in terms of passing between the lines and Partey as well. But it feels like the obvious move, I don't know whether this is just me, I'm speaking purely from a lack of Arsenal knowledge viewpoint here, is to play those two in sitting midfield, maybe Saka or somebody at least creative at 10, and then three forwards, probably Pepe, Aubameyang, and Willian or Martinelli. Like, I don't understand this whole unbalanced sort of situation where players are playing out of position to accommodate other players playing out of position.
Well, I think Martinelli's still out until the end of the year. I think when Martinelli's back, you might see that a little bit more. For the time being, you'd probably go for a front three of Saka, Aubameyang and Pepe, though, or something. I think that would be totally fine. And then you can do your standard midfield three of Xhaka, Ceballos and Partey. Though I thought Ceballos was kind of pushed out to the right wing yesterday, and I thought had probably his worst performance of the season so far. I didn't think he was good at all. So, I mean, it could take some time to learn the ropes there. But the question is whether this is solvable with the players that Arsenal have. Like, they might have just built a squad that's mid-table level, because even if you've got really good attackers, if they don't gel at all, then you're in serious trouble. Like, Lacazette is still better than a lot of strikers in the league, but Arsenal have two centre forwards who can't play together, and Pepe, who doesn't gel with them in any way. So it's a really worrying situation if you're an Arsenal fan. I don't know, the one good thing is the first half yesterday. In the first half yesterday, Leicester couldn't even get on the ball for the first kind of 15 minutes of the second half, even at the end of the game, you know, like,
yeah,
they had one good chance, and they only had another decent chance because Arsenal were then pushing up desperately trying to score.
It wasn't manifesting into great chance creation, though, was it? When I had a look at the XG after the game, it was 0.74 apiece. And that's what impressed me with Leicester. Like, even down that left-hand side of Christian Fuchs at left centre back and James Justin, who is much improved and a player we like, but is by no means an elite fullback in the Premier League. Aubameyang, Bellerin, and even when Luiz was on for first half, were struggling to find space, were struggling to break those guys down. I mean, a lot of that owed to the industry of Mendy and Tielemans, who I thought were brilliant. But it wasn't exactly a, I want to say, star-studded Leicester side, but it was a weakened Leicester outfit as well. And you pretty much had your full strength out, right?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, I'd say, though, it was a very defensive Leicester side. And the thing is, Arsenal so far this season have not managed to put shots on anyone. Arsenal have not managed to, like, run up the shot count on anyone, even if the shots aren't good quality. Like, we can say, okay, they were only getting shots of bad quality, but Arsenal have not even managed to do that so far this season. So for them to have 11 shots in the first half and give up absolutely nothing in return is still an improvement. And also, of course, there are factors like Lacazette doesn't touch that Tierney cross, so it doesn't go down as a shot when it's an open goal. If he gets a touch on it, then we probably get, like, you know, 0.4 XG for that or something. So, like, so there's always a little bit of kind of give in XG here and
there.
It's
that grey area. Yeah, Did you only have one shot in the second half, then? Because you only had 12 shots in total.
Yeah, we had one shot in the second half, which was the Bellerin volley that Schmeichel saved.
Bloody hell.
And Leicester... But then again, Leicester had four shots in the second half. So the second half was kind of, like, pretty dull. But I think that first half, you know, most teams are not going to be as good as Leicester that come to the Emirates. At least they were able to kind of put shots up there. And Leicester in the second half, I think, had the clear idea of, right, okay, we're going to muddy this game up. We're going to defend as much as possible. And we're going to hope we nick something on the break. And they did do that.
Which is traditionally that's really good. Rodgers hasn't done, right? Like, that 3-4-2-1 worked wonderfully against Manchester City as well. And they've got the sort of personnel to make it work second half. Like, Harvey Barnes is there to clearly stretch the play and tire a few players in the first 45. And then with Vardy coming on, like, his plan A is to stay in the game for 60 minutes. And it seems to be working quite well away from home against bigger sides. So when, like, Arteta criticises, you know, Rodgers for putting kind of 10 men behind the ball, that's not historically a string he's had on his bow. And if he can sort of marry that up with the more attacking football he likes to play in that 4-2-3-1 he always religiously deploys at home, then I think Leicester are a much more interesting proposition anyway.
I don't know if I agree with that entirely. Like, because you remember at the beginning of last season, like, we all criticised Leicester for being too defensive. Like, Rodgers, I think, was deploying quite a defensive lineup and quite a defensive mindset there.
And that was away at Chelsea and away at United, right? When they were in...
It was in all, like, the first five or six games of the season, they were generally very defensive. This is when he was, like, really, like, playing an extremely defensive setup. And we were saying at the time, I think this squad is better than Rodgers realises. Whereas in this game, I think it was, like, a clear reaction to having really important players out injured, right? And so he was like, right, okay, I can't play the way I want to play. But now he's managed to coach them up so that they can play this defensive style. Well, I don't know. I don't really want to say that because that kind of implies it was effective and I don't really think it was effective. And I think if that Lacazette goal had stood, then we'd be in quite a different situation. I'm always wary of saying that a plan has worked when, like, somebody misses a header, like, from a yard out or when a goal gets disallowed.
Yeah, which,
like,
is kind of the point I'm trying to make, feels right, dodgy. By saying it is dependent on, like, keeping a clean sheet for the first 60, 70 minutes. Like, this game plan feels like, let's give ourselves the best possible chance in the last, like, 15, 20, owing to, like, having Vardy on the bench. Although he obviously started against City, didn't he? But
yeah, and it's possible as well that if one of those, if Lacazette had scored that chance, or if the goal had counted, then we'd have seen, like, a more attacking Leicester. But they couldn't really get a foothold on the game in the first half. Like, Tielemans had a really bad first half. And, you know, just kind of the lack of, like, a central striker was obviously a problem for them. But I don't know. Like, generally speaking, I'm quite positive about Leicester. I just don't think they were very good in this game. I don't think Arsenal were good either. But, like, Arsenal getting shots is really unusual for Arsenal. I mean, even against Sheffield United, where it was like Sheffield United didn't have a sniff all game, Arsenal had like 7 shots or something in the whole match. So from that point of view, just being able to take shots when they want to, like, looks like Arteta has maybe realised that you don't score goals if you don't have shots, which is something that he should probably have realised earlier in the 9 months he's been in charge of Arsenal. But in a way, it reminded me a little bit of the game against Leicester last season, where Arsenal should have been 3-0 up in the first half, but weren't, and then in the second half got punished, though that was after a red card for Nketiah. But anyway, should we move on to Man City? Because, like, let's be honest, Arsenal are not going to be troubling anyone this season, except people, you know, in the mid-table. Leicester, the peak of Leicester's ambitions this season, I think, is maybe Europa League, but who knows? Like, they have got a lot of people out at the moment. We don't really know. Man City are in a bit of a troubling situation because they drew 1-1 with West Ham, and we've seen them draw games like this in the past, but in the last few weeks, Pep seems to have, like, said, right, I need to stabilise the defence. And his way of doing that is by playing the most boring football matches ever. I mean, Joe, what do you think is going on with City at the moment? Like, because it does seem like they've lost the ability to create those really high quality scoring chances that we associate them with.
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, they obviously have a lot of injury problems at the club right now, which you can't underestimate when it's Laporte, Fernandinho, KDB, Aguero and Jesus with injuries at the start of the season. You're looking at 5 of the best players in the squad all out injured at the same time or around about the same time. Obviously, players coming back to fitness now. But yeah, I actually think there is a little bit of a problem at Manchester City this season. And I think the fans, there's a quiet rumbling of discontent with some of the substitutions that Pep Guardiola's enacting. I know that he brought Zinchenko on for Kyle Walker at the weekend because he wanted to have a left footer at left back when they were attacking to put proper balls into the box and they needed that goal. It felt a weird one. It's so predictable how they want to play. Like you said, it is really dull. Every single player in this Man City team wants the ball into feet. Nobody's spinning in behind. There's no runs off the ball that you'd classically associate with a Pep team looking to stretch sides and get players in that sort of 10 role. And I think that partially comes down to the lack of a actual number 9 being fit. Obviously, Aguero played 45 minutes against West Ham and pulled his hamstring. So he's going to be out for a number of more weeks. I think, obviously, losing Leroy Sané, who had that ability to stretch teams in behind, and failing to replace him with a player like Leroy Sané now seems puzzling, as we said at the start of the summer and we said throughout the whole summer. And Gabriel Jesus, who also likes to do that, being injured doesn't help. But there are big problems at Manchester City, and there's reports of slight disharmony in the dressing room as well around Pep Guardiola. His contract's up in the summer. He was asked about it on Friday. Is he going to stay? Is he going to go? And he gave some really sort of middle ground answer about being happy to go to London and watch the team play against West Ham, which I thought was kind of weird. So I think there's actually big problems at Manchester City. I still think they're going to have a very, very solid shot at the title this season. And once the season settles down and this sort of prolonged almost pre-season for some of the big teams starts to relax a little bit and players come back from injury, they'll be fine. But they look dull. They look boring. Like, I used to actually enjoy watching Manchester City. Against West Ham, I thought they were so boring.
I mean, I completely agree. Like, when Zinchenko came on, it just seemed like he was passing it to De Bruyne for De Bruyne to cross. And to be fair, De Bruyne looked kind of unfit. Like, he played a couple of amazing passes, but he also misplaced more passes than I've ever seen him do in like a 20-minute spell. Like, he kept just passing it to West Ham players, and that was really, really worrying. I mean, Chris, do you think that this is as simple as they get the players back and they're fit, or do you agree with Joe that there's, like, a larger issue here? The loss of that secondary creator in David Silva, the loss of that play-stretching wide man in Leroy Sané?
Well, if it's mainly down to injuries, then they are big issues, right? But they're solvable. If there is discontent in the changing room, that's a little bit kind of harder to legislate for. And Dom Torrent, his old assistant coach, did say that if there are players tiring of the message, then he would need 2 to 3 new faces, which, given the, sort of the amount of money he spent in recent times, feels like a big ask come January or come the summer. So, yes, it is owing to injuries. There are players that are maybe coming to the end of their cycle at the club, but it was odd to see like Garcia start over John Stones, for example, when Garcia has said that he wants to leave, right, and John Stones has said that he wants to stay and fight for his place. I thought the midfield three against West Ham just didn't complement each other at all. Everyone seems to be doubling down on their criticism of Rodrigo at the minute, but I actually thought he was the best player for them in that game by far. Bernardo Silva and Gundogan were pretty much non-existent. I don't think the pair put in a challenge. I think Gundogan had as many shots as Rodri, so it wasn't even as if he was sort of chipping in at the other end. What is striking about Manchester City at the moment, though, is that like plan that they only have a plan A, and that is a little bit cliche, but the amount of times that like a player cut in and had a shot, particularly Raheem Sterling against Leeds, against West Ham, who I mean they were great against Arsenal, weren't they? And you don't just kind of stumble across that performance. That is them at their best, and that is what they're capable of this season. The ceiling does remain very high, like Joe says, but they just keep doing the same thing. And Raheem Sterling is more potent on that right hand side, cutting in and shooting with his stronger foot, but he's become an inferior creator. I think they're missing Leroy Sané. Obviously, any team would miss a player of his caliber, but he really used to stretch the play, didn't he? Like, he was at his best when he was firing in balls from the byline, and the other winger, you know, whether it be Sterling or whether it be Aguero arriving late or whether it be a cutback to KDB, they would sort of thrive on that service. And the same would happen with Sterling on the right-hand side, who would consistently get double digits for both goals and assists, right? So, yeah, I think they missed that genuine width from Sané as well. I think Mendy was supposed to supply that, but he's become a little bit of a liability defensively. I actually think there's a lot more to come from João Cancelo. He was pretty good against West Ham. I was a little bit puzzled as to why he was then dragged over to the right. Apparently, Kyle Walker was knackered, but I think he created two chances from the left. He got an assist as well, didn't he? So it was going quite well for him. His progressions this season and last season have still been very, very good in terms of his entries into the final third. So I do think there's more to come from him from an attacking sense. So maybe a bit more competition for Mendy down that side. But yeah, just variety in their final third play. It's worrying to see how bereft of ideas they are at the moment. But that might change when KDB goes to that back to that sort of floating eight role instead of starting on the left of a midfield three. And yeah, Mahrez has been poor and predictable on the right hand side as well, hasn't he? Which is a nightmare because he's in my draft team. So yeah, I think just entirely predictable up front. But I probably need to just galvanise my thoughts a little bit because it is the drop off is sizable, isn't it?
Well, it just seems like even last year when things were a little bit ropey and obviously there was no Sané then as well, like, they were one of the leading sides in Europe for shots per game, for shots on target per game. Like, when you played City, you knew that you, even if you could create chances yourself, you would probably have to get a little bit of luck to keep them out at the other end. This season, I think they've had two or three games in a row now where they've put up pretty low XG. I mean, even against Arsenal, I thought they probably had another gear to go to and they were clearly the better side, but they weren't running up, you know, like the kind of shot and XG counts that they've done in the past. You know, when they used to batter Arsenal like 3-0, I think they had like 1.4 XG or something. And you think, okay, well, that's enough to get the job done against a poor Arsenal side. But Arsenal were poor last year and the year before, and they would just batter us 3-0 without even trying. I mean, rumours today are linking City with interest in Pochettino and Julian Nagelsmann because, of course, Guardiola's contract situation is still a little bit up in the air. Joe, of those two, can you see City going for either of those? And if so, who do you think they should go for? Who would you expect them to go for?
Thing is, whoever comes in after Pep, you know it's like the nightmare project because the expectations are so high. The squad's so bought into his way of playing that I think it's a really difficult job for whoever comes in. I personally can see Pochettino going to PSG before too long. I would be extremely surprised that if Thomas Tuchel lasts the entire season in Paris this year, especially having watched them against Manchester United, where they were just appalling and half a team looked like a Europa League side. So Pochettino obviously with his links to PSG, I wouldn't be surprised to see him go back there. Nagelsmann, I would be shocked, really, really shocked if they can coax him out of Germany. I think he's got Bayern Munich written all over him. Obviously a huge Bayern Munich fan himself, has spoken in the past about his desire to manage Bayern Munich. So I can see him going to Bayern. I expect Pep Guardiola to sign a new contract, not a long-term one, maybe just another year, because I think he's going to be so desperate to win that Champions League. That was the reason he was brought into the club, to get him over the line to that next step, and it's not quite happened. So I expect Pep to sign a new contract, but whoever comes in, I don't think it will be the high-profile name we're all expecting. I think it's more likely to be someone who's a bit more of like a Pep understudy. In the sort of realms of Mikel Arteta going back to Arsenal, I think it will be somebody a little bit more like that. That would be my opinion.
Interesting. Well, I mean, Pep has now been at City longer than he was at Barcelona. This is his longest job to date. Chris, do you think that the team, that there's a realistic chance of the team improving? I mean, obviously they're better than they are now, but do we see them getting back to that kind of 2017-2018 level when they were 100 point side?
Well, all the noises coming out of City would suggest, you know, they're fairly confident he's going to sign a new contract, right? Their COO, Omar Berada, said that, like, he's comfortable here. And I think that statement was quite telling. Like, one, that might be the problem, or that might be part of the perception, right, that he's not trying anything new, and that going off and having another sabbatical like he did post-Barcelona would rejuvenate him. Like, I think that narrative is probably is quite alluring to some people, but I don't think it's going to happen. Like, the thing at City is no one wields more power than Guardiola. It's not like he's, even if there was a rift in the dressing room that sort of Joe intimated that earlier, like that player is going to be sold, aren't they? Like, there is no problem that they won't try and help Pep solve. And I don't think their succession plan, like, if he's still mulling over a contract, what are we, 6 games into the season, clearly their succession plan isn't at an advanced stage. You've got Goal reporting that it might be Brendan Rodgers. You've got Begristan saying there's only 5 other managers in world football that can do what Pep Guardiola does. I imagine that most of them are tied up at other clubs. And I don't really see a manager where the current talent in the squad, just to go back to your question, PBS, marries up better than right now with sort of with City and Pep. So it would require not just a new manager, but a hell of a lot of new players, right? There obviously are parallels with the Pochettino thing in the sense that, like, these players have been, this core of players have been operating in the same way for so long. Like, do they need a new style of leadership? And that's kind of how people justified Mourinho replacing Pochettino, right? But there's no guarantees to that. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that as an approach. So I am firmly of the belief that this is definitely a situation he can solve. And I think a lot of it will fall into place, obviously, when he gets those players back. It's just whether, I was going to say whether or not the title will be beyond them in a month or 2 months' time. But what he's got going in his favour at the minute is that this has been the most inconsistent start to a Premier League season since like the mid-70s, or the first division season since the mid-70s. So no one's really staked their claim in terms of, like, in a really bold fashion that would force Manchester City's hand, other than maybe Liverpool. But no, I think it's just all bullshit, to be honest.
Okay, well, before we move on to our next section, a quick word from our sponsors, and it is Harry's, old friends of the podcast. Now, obviously, shaving in private at the moment, you don't have to try as hard because you know you're not going to see anybody. But this week, I couldn't actually find my Harry's razor, and I was using just like a beard trimmer I have, and I wasn't paying attention, and I actually cut myself. For the first time in ages. And it did make me think that I've got kind of used to having like a smooth, easy shave and not cutting myself. Like, it felt like I was a teenager again, learning to shave. And I think this is the great thing about Harry's. They create really good quality shaving kits, and they've actually just upgraded their blades. So in order to ensure quality, they bought their own factory in Germany that's been manufacturing razor blades for 100 years. So they've now released their sharpest ever blades with a new lubricating strip to make it even closer and more comfortable. And they haven't raised prices either. So replacement blades are still around £1.75 each, I think, which is incredible stuff. So what we're bringing you today is a trial set from Harry's. You get a weighted ergonomic handle, you get a new 5-blade razor cartridge, a rich lathering shave gel, which will prevent you embarrassing yourself like I did, where I had a tissue paper stuck to my neck, and a travel blade cover to protect your blades on the move. It's like unnecessary to laugh that much, Joe, because it was like it was really quite a lot of blood. Like I was truly worried for a second there. You know when you cut yourself like on your neck or on your arm or something, and you're like,
yeah.
Is this how arteries
are?
Anyway. Yeah, exactly. You're like, oh yeah, there is a load of blood inside my body that wants to get out. But if you want to keep that blood there, then maybe invest in Harry's. Go to harrys.com/extra to claim that trial set for just £3.95. You'll be supporting our podcast by doing so, treating yourself to a nice shave. And when we finally emerge from tier two into a new world, you know, where there are like wolves roaming through Oxford Circus and there are like dolphins in the Thames, then you'll be looking incredibly smart while doing it. So yes, harrys.com/extra for that trial set, just £3.95. So let's move on to our next section where I've got some quick questions for you guys. Now, I was going to ask you whether Arteta is improving Arsenal, but I think the answer to that is a resounding who knows. So yes. So shall we talk about some other things instead? I wanted to ask you, is El Clasico dead? Because I didn't know it was even happening at the weekend.
Don't say that in front of Doogie, mate. He will break down in tears.
Oh, well, he should buy some clothes that aren't football. Anyway, Messi has not scored from open play in six games. Messi's not scored from open play. In this game, Barcelona actually started three teenagers. They had 17-year-old Ansu Fati, 17-year-old Pedri, 19-year-old Serginho Dest, but still got pumped 3-1. Joe, do you actually care about El Clasico? Is El Clasico a factor in world football? Because neither of these sides are going to win the Champions League, and no one really cares who's going to win La Liga.
I have to say, I did have it on in the background, but I really was barely even watching it. It was but an afterthought for me. And yeah, obviously Sergio Ramos did it again, didn't he? Barcelona looked particularly average. With regards Messi, I just feel like he's just given up for Barcelona. Like, we all said that we wanted to see him playing for Manchester City this season. He wanted to play for Manchester City. He hates the board. He hates the club. I don't think he hates on well with Ronald Koeman. Like, what more does Messi have to do to leave? He's obviously going to go in the summer. It was just a nothing game for me. I'm sure there are Barcelona fans and Real Madrid fans listening to this going, no, it's not dead. It's still like alive and kicking, but is it? I can't remember the last time I sat down and watched El Clasico, like years and years ago now.
Yeah, the level has diminished so much from the days when you would see like Bale, Benzema, Ronaldo versus Suarez, Messi and Neymar. And elite midfielders as well, you know, like Modric and Iniesta at pretty much the peak of their powers. Like, it just feels like, I don't know, it just feels like it, like La Liga has lost the thing that made it kind of special a bit. Anyway, let's move on from that. Chris, I want to ask you a Man United question because I feel like you won't be biased. Was Donny van de Beek's move to United a mistake? Sat in the stands looking miserable the whole way through United's horrible draw with Chelsea, which, to be honest with you, was even more boring than Arsenal-Leicester.
Yeah, that was one of the worst games I've watched this season, for sure.
Yeah, Chris, what do you think? Donny van de Beek?
I recorded that game and then just didn't watch it back on like the advice of three or four different people.
Oh my God, it was so boring.
And just went and got pissed instead. So yeah, pretty happy with that decision. I think this question only exists, right, because he's got such a sad little face when he's sitting in the stands and he looks all snuggly and vulnerable in his big raincoat. I think over the course of a season, he's going to make 30 to 40 appearances, you know, whether or not they are starts or whether it's just, you know, predominantly in cup competitions. I still think it was a good purchase. It wasn't a necessary purchase or the most important purchase, but still too early to sort of dismiss it as a waste of 40 million euros. Because, you know, say they didn't pick him up, like, they wouldn't have had a contingency plan for no Donny van der Beek. It just would have been one less player at Manchester United.
That is true.
And you know what will happen? This is what will happen. Around sort of like January, somebody in that creative midfield role will get injured. Be it Bruno, fingers crossed it doesn't happen, or Pogba. Donny will play about 15 games in a row and everybody will go, God, just as well Man United's on Donny van der Beek. What would they have done without his creativity in that midfield hole? That's exactly what happened. We're 5 games into the season.
It's quite worrying five that I'm matches, seeing more good press about Juan Mata than Donny van der Beek, though.
Yeah,
I mean, to be fair to Juan Mata, he's been fantastic at the start of the season, so I wouldn't say that's a disservice to Donny. But Donny will probably start against Leipzig on Wednesday, and like people forget, that's a big game in the Champions League for Man United. We can go 6 points from six in the Champions League group with PSG and Leipzig if we beat them at Old Trafford. Like, if he starts there, then are we still even having this discussion? I think it's just ridiculously early to be writing off this move as like a poor signing by United, some people have been doing.
Yeah. My argument isn't that it's a poor signing for United, it's that Van der Beek might think, oh, maybe I could have waited and gone somewhere else.
To go back to El Clasico, by the way, shout out to Dest. I thought he was really good. I watched probably about 30 to 40 minutes of it. And I think over the course of 90, he completed sort of like double the amount of dribbles as Messi. And you don't know whether that's just Dest, you know, excelling down that right-hand flank or Messi just being, uninterested. But no, I thought him and Coutinho were decent. Obviously, Fede Valverde played really well. And Busquets was not good, but neither was De Jong. So Koeman's plan really coming together, right?
Yeah, basically what we said about Barcelona, this is a horrible write-off year. That's pretty much still my take. Shall we move on to what we learned this week? Because, Joe, I know that you wanted to shine a light on somebody who has never quite had the credit he deserves.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to talk briefly about Patrick Bamford and Leeds because they've been so impressive at the start of the season. And I, for one, didn't think that Patrick Bamford was going to be at the acceptable level for Leeds to sustain a sort of top half push in terms of striking output. And I'm sure 90% of people, if they're being honest with themselves, probably agreed with that statement. But he started the season fantastically well. And Bielsa, what should be nobody's surprise, but will be people's surprise, has found a way of playing him with Rodrigo in that forward line. I think everybody thought Rodrigo would probably replace Bamford at the start of the season. Hasn't been the case. And Bamford is showing that he can do it in the Premier League. The hat-trick against Villa is absolutely magnificent. The goals I think the third goal is better than the second one, where he opens his body up and curls it.
It's like a David Luiz free kick from 15 yards.
It's so, so good. Yeah, and I think Leeds, what was even more impressive about that victory over Villa, obviously Villa had their chances and Grealish probably should have taken a couple of them, but you know that you got to remember, without Calvin Phillips in this team, I think it's a big hole for Leeds to fill, and he's injured for 6 to 8 weeks, and they didn't look any worse. Like, Bielsa is so good that they looked as solid without Calvin Phillips as they did with him. But yeah, I just want to highlight Patrick Bamford, man, because you know he's taken some from me, from most football pundits, I would say, and he's absolutely thriving. So hats off to him.
And a little bit of a victory lap as well, because we kind of hyped him up a little bit before he went to Middlesbrough on loan that season. And then he was rubbish and everyone was like, you were wrong about Bamford. Kind of like Tammy Abraham at Swansea. And so I'm kind of delighted that he's now having a good season and we can claim we were right all along. Chris, yep. What is the thing that you learnt this week?
I think I've already kind of stated mine. And it was that I don't think Rodrigo is the biggest problem at Manchester City. And
he is useless, though.
He's not. And I also think...
I literally wrote in the group chat like a couple of weeks ago when I was watching him, I can't believe we ever hyped Rodrigo. It's useless. And then deleted it and like got on with it.
Wow, that's going to need bleeping. That's for sure going to need bleeping.
Someone take that time code down and get it to Atkins.
40-22.
Well, I actually had a look at his numbers. More ball recoveries than Kante at the start of this season. He's lost possession fewer times than Jordan Henderson in more minutes. More forward passes than Kevin De Bruyne and Pogba. And I think it was Bruno Fernandes. Yeah, Bruno Fernandes
actually. Pogba and KDB have been injured, though.
And they play further forward.
Well, yeah, of course. Like, there's going to be caveats to this. But in general, he's also created five opportunities, which is like three times fewer than KDB and in more minutes. But the bigger picture I'm trying to paint is that he's not as useless at anything as people are making out. He's become the whipping boy for this tough period that Manchester City are going through.
The issue, right, is that he's not useless at any one thing, but he's also not outstanding at any one thing. And they paid 60 million for him.
He's just a tall Jorginho. Like, he's a good passer. Like, he is a very good passer. I defend him on that. And, like, I think he's a useful player. I completely agree with Chris that, like, there's no way I would pin, like, Man City's poor form on Rodri alone.
Yeah, agreed.
But this particular profile of midfielder, I think every time they come to the Prem, they kind of underwhelm. Like, Xhaka and Jorginho, I think, are in the same mold. That, like, obviously not the same standard, but, like, they're never quite mobile enough. They don't do quite enough defence. They don't do quite enough creation. And they're just like sort of spraying the ball from side to side. And it's just like, they're just boring and like not particularly helpful. Like, I mean, I don't know. I just found it weird that last season, the reason that I kind of get on at Rodri is because I remember last season, City fans were defending him and attacking Gundogan. And I thought Gundogan was like, I think Gundogan's a much superior player when he's fit.
But I think with Gundogan and Rodri, the sort of narratives are quite similar in that they will maybe sacrifice elements of their game or be used to plug holes, right? Because they have a solid skill set across the board. Like, no one was getting on at Rodri when he was filling in like adequately at centre half for like half a season. Also, part of my learning thing. Was that Manchester City miss Gabriel Jesus. And there's another player who I think the fans will probably appreciate. You know, now he's been out the side for an extended period of time, or I hope they appreciate him a little bit more. Because at 23, he took a like bizarre amount of flack for not being good enough in sort of in quotes. And I think he is, yeah. And I'm a firm believer that he's going to get better.
Yeah, completely agree. I mean, he's had a couple of bad seasons for finishing, but the chances he does get, he still scores plenty of goals and creates a few as well. So I mean, and he is definitely at that age when you see players achieve liftoff. So it'd be interesting to see what happens once they get everyone back fit and firing. I mean, the thing I learned this week is also about a young player, which is just that maybe I should be paying attention to Lassina Traore at Ajax. Obviously, Ajax this weekend battered Venlo 13-0, which is an Eredivisie record. Now, we've talked about Ryan Gravenberch before. I think I put him in a scout report or a 10 or something ages ago. Before, I'd really seen much of him. Now he's getting linked to Juventus. But Traore, 19 years old, under 20 appearances for Ajax. In this game, he scored 5 and assisted 3. So he hadn't actually scored or assisted so far this season, but after this one game, he's averaging a goal involvement every 27 and a half minutes.
Legend.
He took 8 shots and completed 5 key passes, which were both game highs.
He scored and 5 goals from 8 shots.
Yeah, and Ajax scored more goals in this one game than in their other 5 so far this season.
Mate, do you know what? I put this game on at like 8-0, just because I was like, what the hell is going on? There's a postman at my door, my bad. But the state of Venlo. They were down to 10 men and they were refusing to run.
I mean, they've now got the worst goal difference in the Eredivisie, so that's what happens when you refuse to run. I mean, though, do you know what Ajax's goal difference is after 6 games? Like, it's plus 21.
Yeah, but any team with 4 V's in their name deserves a battering. What is VVVV Venlo?
Well, one of them will be like football. Which is spelt with a V in Dutch. I don't know what the rest is.
Nah.
But
consonant, please, yeah. Carol. Carol?
Yeah. V is a consonant, mate. Come on.
It's no, Venlo's Wurzburg ever... Venering Venlo.
What?
Is there Venlo's in there twice?
Venlo's vert ball, Venerengenigen, Venlo.
Okay. Good,
the
good
end
times.
Of this podcast has gone off piste.
Yeah, I think that probably does bring us to the end of this week's episode. thanks for joining me, guys. What should people go and check out after this, Chris?
The one-on-one on Dutch football, actually. Well, it covers it a little bit. AZ Alkmaar and Billy Bean's role there as a potential new owner at Liverpool. Part owner. That is part of the ownership team. Go and check it out on Euro Football Daily.
Interesting. And Joe?
Go watch Winners and Losers as well. We did a slightly deeper dive on some of the games we've mentioned here, but also focusing on Southampton's fantastic start to the season, beating Everton there as well. So well worth a watch.
Thank you very much, guys. And thank you to you for watching or listening. If you do listen to this podcast using a podcast app, then please also go to Football Daily Podcast on YouTube and subscribe. And if you're watching this on Football Daily's podcast YouTube channel, Football Daily Podcasts, the YouTube channel, please also subscribe to it as an audio podcast because it really helps us out. And of course, harrys.com/extra for that trial set, just £3.95. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.